I'm importing a priest from Canada.
Oh, okay.
And he has talked about trying to get the Mass translated into Elvish. So...
Mass in Elvish. Can we have a Klingon Mass? We probably actually could translate the Mass into Klingon, because there are many, many resources to by which we might do so.
Yeah, I mean, we could, but I don't want a Klingon.
As I say, the problem is someone would take it seriously, and it would be a thing.
That would be the ugliest Mass ever. You might as well say the Mass in German.
You speak from first-hand experience.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that would be the ugliest thing ever, because I've been to folk messes. This is probably more news for Mike and me to savor than for you, but I don't know if you played this game, Sam. Apparently J.J. Abrams is going to make a Portal movie.
Really?
Really.
Oh my gosh.
I have no idea how this could work.
It's not a movie, but okay.
But yeah, we talked last time about the right formats for things. Like sometimes the best format would be like a mini-series. Like they did Childhood's End as a mini-series. Absolutely the right call. It wasn't great, but that was the right vehicle. I don't see how you could make a Portal movie, but this is a shut up and take my money kind of situation.
I could see how it could be a movie because there's a definite end.
Yeah.
They escape the Aperture laboratory facility. You have that going on. But what's interesting is that there's no main character except for GLaDOS.
Right.
Portal.
The first person character is called Chell, but by design, as all these first person characters are, she's not really a character so much as a shell.
And, you know, thinking about it is making me sad, because what they're going to have to do is, you know, there's going to be the guy, and there's got to be a girl, and maybe there's going to be a comic relief, and so there's going to be three people, at least, running around the facility with portal guns, trying to figure it out and escape from GLaDOS.
The multiplayer version has two robots, so maybe they'll go down that path.
Huh.
So, I mean, that's one way to do it. I mean, that's the problem. It is a more plot-driven game than, you know, the games when I grew up. Not nearly as much. I mean, like games like Mass Effect, as I understand it, you have a full-blown plot. You could make a Mass Effect movie.
No, Mass Effect is a movie.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like a movie you experience first. But what was it, Hardcore Henry? It's basically the predicate.
Yeah.
The precursor to that. But although it has plot points in it, the meat of it is the fun of playing around and the puzzles. I don't see how that could possibly translate unless you do basically a feature-length version of, if you remember the commercials when that game came out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you'd reach the point of diminishing returns really fast, but that trailer was absolutely insane. I think that was one of the first video game trailers I remember seeing and said, sold. It had all of the physics bending stuff and so on.
I mean... For me, the way you actually make that movie work is you stay close to the source and that there's only one person, kind of get into this idea of isolation. You're by yourself, and then there's just a voice.
Yes.
There's isolation, a voice. Maybe bring the robots along and something happens to the robots or not. But I'm afraid that they're going to take it and they're going to have like five people running around and they're going to get into zany adventures and
the isolation
stuff like that.
Thing might work very nicely, apart from keeping costs down. But if you're going to do it, I mean, that you remember a movie called Cube there, where you did have five people, but part of the theme was isolation and separation. I mean, and honestly, I think you can get away with a lot. I mean, have you read the or heard snippets of GLaDOS? Do you know what we're talking about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, she's the AI overlord who forces you to use portal guns in really creative ways to escape her.
But more importantly, she's just got this kind of lilting, sarcastic, passive-aggressive mien that you can't recast that. There's only one way.
No.
This is the whole reason I went to see Pacific Rim, because they cast the voice of GLaDOS as the voice of the computer for like three scenes.
Wow.
There's like three lines in there, and it was enough.
Mm-hmm.
It was good enough. Ellen something, I forget her I forget her last name now, but she's really good. And you'll have lines like there's like a seesaw kind of thing, and she says, "You know, you broke it. It must not be calibrated for someone of your generousness." It's just like you play that game enough, and the voice just kind of gets into your head. It's a lot of fun. I did, by the way, a taxonomy of the way that the podcast seems to flow. We seem to start with something fun, and then we do politics, Catholicism, if there's Catholicism stuff, theoretical and philosophical stuff, and then we end with science. And so I think we have plenty of those things to talk about today, so we can follow that structure.
Well, you forgot the most important thing.
What's that?
Beer.
Beer, that's right. Good segue.
Thank you, thank you.
And what are you drinking?
I'm having a Einger Urweiss, which is a dark wheat beer from Germany. And it is my favorite dark wheat.
I'm drinking, we're on the St. Bernardus stuff again. Is this Abbott 12 or ABT 12? I suppose Abbott 12. And it almost tastes like it's a honey beer. It has a very kind of honey aftertaste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very nice. It's got a very interesting, unique aftertaste. I'm having that as well. It's very good.
This week in Marvel, Luke Cage has reemerged, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. got less coy about who the new director is, which was long after due. Did you guys watch either of those?
Nope.
Okay.
No, but I do plan to get a brief free trial of Netflix just to see the Luke Cage.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Yeah, it looks really good.
We are two episodes in, and yeah, so far, I watching it, I've been thinking a lot about what Mike said a couple of episodes ago, about them letting each property have its own tone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like Jessica Jones,
okay.
And it's not like Daredevil. Yeah, I we're really enjoying it so far.
I'll have to check that out then.
Yeah, I think we started episode 3 before knocking it on the head because it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly realized, oh yeah, sleep.
How would you describe its tone?
That's a really difficult question to answer. It is set in Harlem and dealing with not so much racial issues as I would say class issues of the hustling class, as it were.
Interesting.
How do you make it through life, and what are your responsibilities as a superhero who doesn't particularly want to be a superhero,
mm-hmm.
Who just who had this thrust upon him, and what is he going to do with this? Does he have a responsibility to help his community, and if so, in what way? But he doesn't so much seem resentful of it and worn out in the way that Jessica Jones does, so much as or giddy about it in the way that Tony Stark does. More that the kind of a world weariness and a stoicism. And it's really good. I'm enjoying it a lot. And what I'm not clear on yet is where it intersects with Jessica Jones, because of course Luke's in Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
My feeling is that it's before. I think it's between Avengers 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that it's right after Avengers 1. But they haven't really given us enough time markers yet. But, you know, you have people on the streets of Harlem hawking the best footage you'll find anywhere of the incident or the invasion or whatever Marvel's in-house language is for it. So my sense is that we're right after Avengers 1 in the same kind of time frame as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 1. So, you know, I'm enjoying it so far. As I say, we're two episodes in, but, you know, we keep talking about peak Marvel, and this so far hasn't been it, so.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it in part because of the musical selections.
Oh, yeah?
I saw one, I guess you would call it a trailer,
mm-hmm.
For the Luke Cage series, and they were using a track called Mastermind from one of Nas's albums.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good track, one of my favorites. And I thought, oh, well, if they're going to bring that kind of music into the series, sold.
I imagine they will, because they are trying to, I suspect they are trying to be race conscious as well as class conscious, and to bring in elements of all that.
Yeah, I did see a blurb of a review saying, you know, this is a black bulletproof superhero in a hoodie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously making comparisons to all of the incidents of the protests with black men being shot,
mm-hmm.
wearing hoodies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so far, so good. As I say, we'll see how it goes. If you guys haven't watched it, we'll skip over Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Other than just to say, they kind of prick tease for the whole of the first episode and part of the end of the last season of who is the new director. Mm-hmm. This hit the point of diminishing returns about halfway through the last episode, so I was glad that they just got on with it and moved on to director Mace, and that they're going to bring S.H.I.E.L.D. back, so presumably by the time of Infinity War, S.H.I.E.L.D. will be players on the stage again, which maybe you've seen the fan-made posters for Infinity War that includes the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. cast. Maybe, Russo brothers.
We'll see. Well, I don't know. That's been the big thing, hasn't it? Whether or not, how much does this TV show interact?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the lines from the bigwigs
is
they want to keep it separate.
Yeah, which I think is epically foolish, particularly when you're building something like Civil War, or what we assume Infinity War will be, where you need to have a big cast of established characters.
Mm-hmm.
Civil War was quite deft about introducing Black Panther, moderately deft about introducing Spider-Man. You know, they got it done quickly. They didn't spend a lot of time doing the establishment. But it's like, you have these characters that are already established on television. I don't understand why you wouldn't make use of them. Mm-hmm. This makes no sense to me, but Such in Marvel we trust. You know, they have not yet let us down, so we'll see if they continue.
Very true.
To do so. I guess we should talk about the debate, like grown-ups, like we're serious people.
Well, there weren't any serious people in the debate, so why do we need to talk about it like that?
Continuing my streak of being wrong about absolutely everything.
Yes.
I really felt watching it that Trump won. And I say that as someone who is probably the least well-disposed to Trump of anyone on the planet, except possibly Hillary. Mm-hmm. I thought that he won in the sense that he spoke effectively to the people that he needed to reach out to. But all of the polling since has shown him down 1%, 0.5%. So by that, I mean, when I say won, to be clear, what I mean is effective. The point is made, well, Hillary was, had way better answers and was way smarter and ran rings around him. Well, that's nice, but all that really counts is, do you go up in the polls or down in the polls? I thought that it would push him up a little, and it doesn't seem to. He seems to have sunk a little, so.
I saw a theory about that, which is that whenever Trump goes on the attack against a woman, he tends to lose ground. Mm-hmm. And Trump really only has one mode of doing things when it comes to anyone who's standing in his way of winning, which is attack.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's amazing that we're at this point. I mean, we have two candidates that couldn't be lower. I remember hearing something on the Three Martini Lunch from, I think, a week before the debate. Charlie Crist in Florida was involved in a debate for a seat down there. I think he's running for Congress again as a Democrat or something. And so they asked him, do you support Hillary Clinton? And he said, yes, and I support Hillary Clinton because of these three reasons. And he listed off two reasons, and the third he says, because she is honest. And the entire room burst into laughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're a horrible candidate whenever your honesty is quite literally a punchline.
In a Democrat-friendly crowd.
Yeah,
I occasionally see articles sympathetic to Hillary that, kind of drift past on the Facebook feed. And it's like they're coming in from a parallel world. Even though I have a lot of Democratic friends, most of them are I wouldn't say unenthusiastically backing Hillary, but when you see these ones that are actually trying to make these defenses, it's just like, actually the most qualified candidate in history. Is she really? She was in the Senate for 6 years. She was Secretary of State for 4 years. I think you'd have to work quite hard to find any candidate who was not at least that qualified. How many years was Dick Cheney Secretary of Defense, and before that in Congress? I mean, it's not difficult. Hillary's been scored actually one of the most honest candidates. Has she really? I mean, the whole email thing, this isn't a mirage. the Republicans may be playing it for everything it's worth, but that's because it's worth quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's been repeatedly found to be very at least cagey with the truth.
You got to prove your loyalty. You know, I think that's what it's ultimately about.
This is a very tribal election, isn't it? I mean, what is the case for voting for Trump if you're a Republican, other than that he won the Republican nomination? He doesn't believe any of the things Republicans used to believe.
Yep, I think the case is he's not Hillary Clinton.
But isn't that just tribalism by proxy?
Yep.
You know, I mean, it seems like there is a particular opprobrium on Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Like you never see the kind of the viciousness towards Tim Kaine that you see towards Hillary Clinton. There seems to be some uniquely personal affront with her. I don't think it's because she's female. I think it's because she's Hillary Clinton. But
yeah,
there's something about her that just sets people on edge.
No, it's, you know, the 90s was a tempest in a teacup. There was a lot of bad blood that really developed, especially on the right towards the Clintons.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Clintons were, at least in the eyes of a lot of people on the right, so egregious with their habitual lying, with their, you know, you had their dealings in Arkansas, and all of these things that kind of built up, but the Republicans were never able to get that over into, you know, permanent scandal, because Bill Clinton was just so charismatic of a figure.
Slick Willie, they used to call him.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's carried over to Hillary Clinton, understandably. The difficulty Hillary Clinton has is that she has all of that scandal baggage, but she doesn't have the charisma of Bill Clinton, as we talked about last time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's not as good a politician, which may be a personal compliment. That might be the nicest thing I've ever said about her. But,
I think it is. By far, I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said about her.
But, you know, she's just not very good at the basic elements of politics.
So what about Donald Trump's reaction to the debate? Have you guys followed that at all?
No.
So I did watch a bit of a clip. Apparently he went to the spin room after the debate and did some spinning. And his spin was that it was apparently exciting and
a tremendous win for him. You're going to be surprised by his poll numbers by the end of the week.
Yeah, he thought it was one of those things where you don't exactly know what's coming up. And
well, because there's a few things. One, we have his 3 a.m. tweets. I don't know if you guys...
The ones about Alicia Machado?
Yeah.
No, I haven't followed. Yeah. I felt like I was doing yeoman's work by watching the debate. Now you want me to follow him on Twitter? That's
No. Just follow the news on Twitter. Just follow his Twitter news.
Okay.
So
what happened? 3 a.m.
So
tweets.
He
didn't
was
Hillary
called...
have a campaign commercial back in 2008 that you want someone who's awake and tweeting at 3 a.m.?
Not tweeting.
Oh,
at least not Donald Trump. We know, you know, he won't answer the phone call at 3 a.m., but he will tweet about it. Apparently, Hillary Clinton brought this figure up during the debates. A former Miss Universe contestant who he berated shortly after she won. He called her fat and stuff like that.
That must be an insult in Trump world.
And, you know, fat bottom girls make the rockin' world go round, but not necessarily Miss Universe pageants. So he then, at 3 a.m., goes on this whole spiel talking about how Hillary Clinton was taken by her, how she's not really who she says she is, you need to check out her sex tape, she's such a... Yeah.
Wait, Hillary's sex tape?
No.
Okay.
The Miss Universe. And so he just does this whole thing, calling again to light, and he thinks this is helping him.
Mm-hmm.
By directing people to her sex tape.
I'm at a loss to understand how, one, that helps him, and two, he could think that would help him.
Yeah.
I'm underwater with women. Let's do something really crass and tasteless towards women.
Exactly. And then it's in the days following, some of his staffers started to say, yeah, the debate, it didn't go well, but we're going to do what we can to re-engage. We're going to have Chris Christie doing the debate prep. It's been leaked that during his debate prep, he didn't actually do debate prep.
You know, I am personally
surprised,
shocked, yeah, by that.
Yeah, he, like, normally debate prep, you're gonna have podiums and you have someone physically stand in for the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do that. He kind of just went over talking points and he's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna talk about this. I'm gonna talk about that." So his staffers were saying, "Yeah, we're gonna do real debate prep this time around," and he then goes on a rant against his staffers, apparently in a closed meeting. He tells them, tell everyone that the debate went well. I don't want to hear you guys say the debate went poorly. And then he tweeted out, everyone in my staff actually says that the debate went well. If you have any news that says otherwise, don't listen to it. My debate actually went really well.
I caught part of that, though. It's all similar to that. He apparently said something about, don't believe anything that sources from mm-hmm. my campaign say.
Yep.
There are no sources, which will come as an enormous surprise to the journalism profession,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, nothing to see here. All is calm. All is well.
What Western Front?
Yep.
Right. Not even fighting on the Western Front.
Yep. So, it's interesting. You know, he was able to kind of pretend to be presidential for almost a month. You know,
you're being a bit generous, but all
right. I am, yes. He was able to kind of pretend to meet the minimum qualifications needed of a presidential candidate. Minimum.
Hmm.
Of almost a month.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Mexico.
I think he's grown.
Yeah. Clearly. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I don't get it. And then we have, of course, Ted Cruz bending the knee.
I think... epically disappointing would be the way to...
Now I don't have to support Ted Cruz. That's what I can say about that.
But the thing that I don't understand, I mean, even if you assume that it's okay that Cruz basically operates on the premise of whatever will help me right now, which is a very Trumpian premise,
mm-hmm.
I'll say what I need to say right now, it doesn't bind me in the future. Does he not understand that the Trump people aren't going to forgive him for what he did before, and the Never-Trump people aren't going to forgive him for this. So unless he's got a big future in getting Democrat votes, I don't understand who he thinks he's going to vote for.
I heard an interesting theory on one of the podcasts, I can't remember, that there's this wealthy family that funded his re-election campaign and is currently in bed with Trump, making a lot of money off of Trump's efforts, and that they took him aside and said, you need to endorse him or else.
Yeah. And, you know, that seems, I don't know about the details, but the general outline of big donor says, get on board or I'm done giving you money, seems very plausible.
Yeah.
You know, the wonder is that it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, We still have Ben Sasse.
We still have Ben Sasse.
We still have Ben Sasse.
In private, the leadership seems to be fleeing. And the sad thing is that they're not doing so publicly. But maybe they just don't feel that they can.
Yeah, I mean, right now, it's too late. Let the train fly off the rails now, and then denounce the entire movement come January.
And hope that the internet has a short memory. Nothing's written down anymore, right?
Yeah.
You know, the internet forgets everything.
Well, I think part of the problem may be that politicians are continuing to operate on the premise that their biggest block of voters are boomers who don't necessarily spend so much time on the internet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's not going to be true for very long. So either they're going to figure out very quickly that it's not true, and that will be an advantage to them going forward, or they won't figure it out, and it will be a disadvantage.
It kind of reminds me of what's going on right now of the corruption argument. In a corrupt society, you persecute the honest people.
Hmm.
And so this idea, all of the politicians who already have the stain want everybody to have the stain. Because, you know, if all the politicians on the Republican side have endorsed Trump, like, they think, what's going to happen? Where are you going to get someone who hasn't endorsed Trump from?
Mm-hmm. Well, they just assume that the possibility of just not voting for any of them doesn't cross anyone's mind.
Yeah, exactly. But I look forward to certain magazines holding them to account from that. I think that's going to happen.
Yep. On that note, we should point out as a follow-up to last week's discussion, I went and looked at the Balanced Rebellion site that you pointed us towards.
Did you get a match? Did you swipe right?
I didn't actually sign up because I'm not going to vote for Johnson, but... because he's just... Actually, Kevin Williamson has an excellent piece in the mm-hmm. current edition of the print.
I was just hoping you would get a match. It'll be true love.
True love. Marriage. That dream within the dream. Anything you want to tell us, Mike? I went and looked at it and they have a video explaining their pitch, and I was surprised by how. I mean, okay, so granted, you know, I'm a granddad in my late 30s. You know, my sense of what's cool with the kids may be a little off. But I was surprised.
Being very generous to yourself, but okay.
I was surprised because I did not think it was at all naff. And when you were just talking about politicians, always seem to be like a generation behind. With, you know, whenever they try and make jokes, it always seems really stilted. And I was surprised that I watched that video and I thought. It was pretty cool. I thought this was fun. I liked the jokes. I thought that it was, you know, that it was well done. I'm not voting for Gary Johnson, but I thought that this was a pretty well done pitch. And anyone who is inclined to vote for Johnson would probably find it quite persuasive.
It was probably made by millennials.
Yeah.
For millennials.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, Johnson knows where he's getting his votes from.
Yeah.
And it's not from the boomers, with whom he actually has a great deal in common.
Yes, generally. Yeah.
So it's strange, but he actually seems to get more votes from millennials who have less in common with him than the boomers.
Pot! I'm sorry, terrible cough. Pot!
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
He's basically a Rockefeller Republican who likes weed. That's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way I think of him is that he's not, strictly speaking, I don't think he's a libertarian. In the sense that liberty is the maximizing value that he believes in as a core political value.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that he has, you know, fairly typical boomer pseudo-hippie era values mm-hmm. that happen to lead him to conclusions that are at least somewhat amenable to libertarians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, the social liberalism and tolerance combined with I want to be free to own my own business and not have the government come in and shut down my lemonade stand and harsh my buzz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I think he has committed political malpractice this year, as we've talked about before, I know you don't wholly agree on that, but the Libertarian Party could have nominated just about any other Libertarian in the country, and that person could have done better.
But nobody has.
I do not know enough libertarians.
Well, yeah. Fair enough. But most of the ones. So, like, if they had nominated Kevin Williamson, for example, I would have been happily voting for Kevin Williamson.
There's a reason why he's a pundit and not a, you know, a politician.
Because he's smarter?
Yeah, because he's not insane.
There were other people. Yes, there were other people who were running for the Libertarian nomination.
None of, like.
There were.
The thing about it is that he's a well-known former governor.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the pedigree. He's got the credentials. You know, if you're going to nominate someone else, you're going to nominate someone who tried three times to win a city council seat and failed.
Mm. Well, but the argument seems to be that in a year where the Republican Party have nominated someone on the moderate centre-left, and that's going to slaughter him at the polls, that what people really want is someone from the moderate centre-left who isn't crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I just someone who's neither crazy nor politically terrible. That would be the dream.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking that, and you know what? I think we have a title for this episode, don't we? A dweem within a dweem.
Oh, gosh. Jeez, yeah.
I gotta go home and watch Inception now.
Or The Princess Bride.
Yes.
Watch them both at the same time.
Oh, I'm liking this. With Dark Side of the Moon playing.
There you go. Yeah. We're going to be doing a lot of acid after this podcast.
The Princess Bride and Inception while listening to Dark Side of the Moon and really baked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the quadfecta.
James Cobb was the Dread Pirate Roberts. Yes. Wow.
Is anybody else seeing that tiger?
Oh my goodness. Apart from the weed part, this actually does sound quite entertaining. Because, I mean, it's only going to last 40 minutes.
Hey.
This was the problem with the theory was, what was it, that the Wizard of Oz syncs up with Dark Side of the Moon. But the Wizard of Oz is like 90 minutes, and Dark Side of the Moon is like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So, did either of you see Trek v. Trump?
I saw something about it. Like, ooh, a whole bunch of people from Star Trek signed a letter saying don't vote for Trump.
I saw that too, and I just chuckled and moved on with my life.
Yes.
It swayed so many votes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really going to send a red message to those blue-collar workers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would have been funnier if they did like a little commercial where they're like, don't be a red shirt.
Yeah.
Red shirts vote for Trump, and you know what happens to red shirts on the away team.
You can imagine, we did the Hillary Clinton thing doing the bit last episode, and you can imagine her doing the same kind of stilted attempt at making that delivery. It's like, don't swipe right on Donald Trump. It's like, don't be a red shirt.
Yeah.
End of line. No, the thing that struck me about it was that they said that... that there is, it's unimaginable there could be a candidate as antithetical to Star Trek's values as Donald Trump. And that may well be true, but Star Trek's values are horrifying. You know, the Federation is a nightmarish dystopia, and I thought that everyone knew that, but apparently people don't think that at all.
No,
but...
they haven't thought this through. I am still going around spreading the light of Star Trekian dystopia. Yeah.
A friend posted a cracked video that I thought did pretty well covering most of the points I always wanted to hit. It didn't hit on how awful the Prime Directive is, which I think we've talked about on a previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
It did hit on one that I thought was really clever and interesting, given the biases of the people that made the show, which was this idea that the most precious commodity in the Federation is novelty. That this is a civilization so epically bored that they send their best and brightest out anywhere. Just find us something cool. Anything new that we haven't thought of. And I thought that was really interesting. It does seem to me that that kind of restless need for novelty is one of the kind of things that predispose people to be politically progressive. That you need to have... a constant drumbeat of change because what we've already got's not good enough, even if it was all we desired yesterday. So that was a pretty interesting one. My go-to is always the engineering of Star Trek, which is horrifying. And perhaps more to the point, the complete indifference of everyone in universe to how horrifying it is, that it is entirely acceptable to everyone in this universe that the ship routinely blows up from no imaginable amount of damage. Well,
I mean... there's historical precedents for really shoddy engineering. There's historical precedents for having machines that run well but do not take into account the lives of the crew. I'm thinking of like everything made by Soviet Russia. but those people in Russia didn't load their entire families aboard the tank.
Right.
That's, to me, that's the real horror of Star Trek, is that you have this Enterprise ship, and it's out there, and there are women and children, like, entire families aboard this ship that every two episodes is being taken over by something, and, how many times did they have to detach the salsa section? That's nuts.
Right. And one episode where... which actually perfectly exemplifies how nutty the engineering is, where it's basically got the throttle stuck open. Like, remember those Hondas that went out of control? It's like, we're approaching maximum speed, Captain. Prepare for emergency saucer separation. Wait, I have a question. So your problem is you're going at maximum speed, so you want to put your entire family in a bit of the ship and rip it off and see what happens. you know, apart from the fact it's going to keep going at the same velocity, you're in space.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you are separating it from the system that could slow it down. Right.
Yeah.
So, but that's just, you know, Star Trek being ignorant about basic physics. But the other thing that I didn't understand was, if you're approaching maximum velocity, this is a self-correcting problem. You'll approach it, you'll reach it, and then you'll be at maximum velocity. What's the problem here? I don't understand. You can't, by definition, go faster. Eventually, you'll run out of fuel, as long as you don't hit anything. And presumably, you can do that. You know, just put the ship in a loop.
You're in space.
Yeah.
You mean it's difficult to hit things in space?
I'm just picturing the Enterprise just going around really, really fast.
Right.
Yeah, but then it would be like the NASCAR episode.
Yeah.
Just make left turns over and over and over.
Stardate 1.363.
Shake and bake, Jordy. We continue
to turn left.
Oh, gosh.
I wonder how many of the, like, you know, there's families aboard this ship. And, like, there's been plenty of episodes where they've lost life supports to decks 1 through 37. Mm-hmm. How many kids died?
Right. Yes.
You know, how many, Jean-Luc Picard, how many kids did you kill? Please let us know.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And no one seems to have a problem. I mean, this is why the best shows in that world are the ones that Gene Roddenberry had the least to do with. Because Roddenberry was the principal problem.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine is by far the best iteration of Star Trek. Voyager could have been, but for the problem that we talked about last time, which is that when you try to serialize a show where the concept of serialization is at war with the premise of the show, you're in trouble. But Deep Space Nine, I went back and rewatched from you know, the pilot onward last summer, and it still holds up really well. It's still an interesting show because there's conflict. It's like Gene Roddenberry's like, oh, in the future there'll be no conflict. Oh, really? That's a big problem if you're making a show that is built on the concept of conflict.
There's always a conflict between somebody's desire to wear a red shirt and their desire to survive on the away team.
But that's one of the cultural rot elements in it. That this entire society, everyone wears the same unitards, and no one has a problem with this. This is, you know, the correct video makes that point as well. So I won't rehash it. But yeah, the two that they skip over that I would want to point to are the engineering and people's complete indifference to. It should never be possible for the reactor to run out of control and the systems that shut down the reactor to fail. And we're supposed to believe that after 200 years, engineers have completely forgotten how to not kill everyone. And then, as Mike says, loaded their entire families onto the ships. And no one cares that this is just okay. That this is just, you know, situation normal. That does not strike me as a healthy utopian society. Yeah, I found that fascinating that everyone just seems to assume that Star Trek is a utopia and that we should all want to be more like Star Trek. It's like, no, I don't think so. I mean, that's one of the things that I find interesting about things like Babylon 5 and The Expanse, that this is a plausible future. Like, if we're going to get out there, this is kind of how you can see humanity functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Star Trek, not so much. And I say I like Star Trek a lot, but, you know, on a dramatic level, but in terms of thinking about the implications of the universe, no. If you're telling me that the vote for Trump is a vote against the Star Trek future, you're not making the argument you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we got? Sam, you had posted a post on Altea by a Jesuit that amused me. It amused me because it was written by a Jesuit about why are the young fleeing the church? And then there was an article in the New York Times, of all places, earlier this week asking, has Pope Francis failed? I just love the coincidence of these two articles because surely the answer is yes, by every conceivable metric. So, you know, not only have you done terrible things, they've not even succeeded by their own standards. And so why are people leaving the church? Well, because, you know, you're doubling down on a solution that hasn't worked in 50 years and isn't going to start now.
I don't know. What were you thinking whenever you posted the article?
Mostly I was interested to see that it was a Jesuit who was proposing that there was a reason for young people not being in the church, and it wasn't what baby boomers assumed it was, which I think is the case. Is they're making the wrong assumptions about what's causing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not, for example, that we don't have relatable enough music. Although that's true. I mean, if you're a baby boomer, we have very relatable music in most American parishes. If you're a millennial, maybe if you're one of the people who really likes 60s-era folk music or 70s-era folk music, you think the music is pretty cool. And there are some millennials who do. And so you do see a small percentage of millennials who are very favorable towards that style of music, and they're totally with it and hip to it and all that.
They're very into Mumford and Sons.
Yes, they probably are. I like my...
See how I'm hip with the kids there with that three-year-old reference.
Yes. There you go. Yeah.
Yes, I prefer my authentic bluegrass, but whatever. Maybe that's just because I'm a millennial. I don't know.
That might be your most hipster line on the show so far.
Well, it was intentional. So, you know, it's certainly not what the baby boomers think is the problem. And I'm not sure that the Jesuit article is right about it either, but it's certainly worth thinking about. Well, it's clear that the old fix isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And that doubling down on the old fix hasn't really accomplished anything. So let's look at other arguments for what it may be, and let's seriously consider what these causes might be, and maybe try some different things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I've said before that I favor the market approach. You know, you have 5 parishes in town. Between them, there's, you know, 15 masses over the course of the weekend. If they're all the same, that's... I'm not necessarily a fan of diversity for its own sake. They should all be excellent. But it would stand to a certain amount of reason that if you want to find out what people actually want, you have some diversity in the choices available to them, and you see what people do.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems obvious to me. I mean, the reveal preference is a much better indicator of people's actual preferences than asking them on a survey.
Yeah, particularly when the survey that you use doesn't work on their smartphone.
Yeah.
Their laptop or their tablet.
Well, I mean, or in this context, if it only works on those things, because you have a lot of parishioners who are older who do not have those things.
Indeed.
Or, like, I know at St. Joe's they recently did a survey.
Mm-hmm.
And so it asks the questions, like, you know, what's your opinion about the liturgy? What's your opinion about the music? But it's like, how much you like 1 to 5?
Hmm.
You know,
yeah,
there's no
scale.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some advantages to that. Like
for data collection.
Yeah. For data collect, it's great, but there's nowhere to say what you dislike about it because
yeah, they can't do root cause analysis based on the Likert scale.
Yeah. The problem at a lot of parishes isn't necessarily just the, you know, there is a problem at a lot of parishes about the quality of music in general. But that's not just the problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, suppose you are a big fan of David Haas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All you want is more David
Haas.
Yes. And the parish is doing a lot of it poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And what you really want to do is to indicate that you want the same material done better.
Yeah.
And so you give it a nice big fat 1 because they're really making a mess of your lovely David Haas melodies,
yes.
Right? And I get homicidal every time I hear any, two notes of his put together, and so I also give it 1. So congratulations, your survey is now worthless because I am scoring someone this exactly the same. It's like the survey that goes around of people who think America is on the right track versus people who think America is on the wrong track.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, everyone thinks it's on the wrong track at the moment. And it's like, well, that's great, but, you know, that's because half of them want to go this way and half of them want to go that way.
Yep.
There is no common ground.
Exactly. Exactly.
A large part of the problem we have with political discourse and thinking about politics in the United States is that we start from very different moral intuitions and we start from very different assumptions about what should drive our political decisions. And we start from very different assumptions, even about what evidence is admissible in a political discussion. And if you have that level of fundamental difference, you're going to have to start at the level of, all right, let's first talk about, before we even touch on politics, let's first talk about what counts as evidence and what weight does that kind of evidence have.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have that level of discussion first
mm-hmm.
because that's what's driving the discord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's evidently a difficult decision to have. I just read an article, I think, in the Washington Post about a Trump supporter, and they basically kind of followed her for a day and had conversations with her. And, you know, she was dissatisfied with her life and increasingly outraged by President Obama. And so when she read on Infowars.com or whatever that he was probably a Muslim, oh, and by the way, probably gay, and oh, by the way, Michelle is probably a transsexual in one direction or the other, it made sense to me.
Mm.
Oh, good. I'm glad that these postures make sense to you. Do you think they're very likely? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it makes sense is not the criterion for that which is true. You know, mm-hmm. Even assuming for sake of argument that these things do make sense, it's like, you know, how do you have the kind of discussion that you're talking about when I'm trying to remember what the line from Blazing Saddle is, like, with these people, the common clay of mankind, the normal people, the simple people, farmers, you know, idiots. You know, I mean, how do you...
I believe that was the line, yeah.
How do you have the discussion, the meta-level discussion that you're talking about, which, by the way, is a lovely segue, if you want to talk about it, into the Cognitive Bias Codex that you posted, which I love. So if you want
to talk about that one.
My erstwhile co-blogger Pat and I were both big fans of Edward Tufte and data visualization, and the data viz that goes with that article is gorgeous. I'm almost tempted to order a copy of the poster size version of it. Did you see this?
No, I don't think I have.
I thought that you might not, and so I wanted to bring it with me. So I have it for you here. It's essentially a taxonomy of all of these biases and fallacies. And the post is very good too, but the data viz on it is awesome. I mean, I'm very impressed. I mean, it's not a complicated data viz, but most of the good ones are simple. I don't know that it would have occurred to me to do it that way, and so I'm very impressed. But do you want to talk about the substance of it before I geek out about the artistic beauty of it?
Sure. The article is called Cognitive Bias Cheat Sheet. And the author wanted to kind of provide a breakdown of different cognitive biases in a more productive way than the Wikipedia article on cognitive biases, which just has a list, and it's not particularly coherent.
A means more productive than the Wikipedia article? Is this possible, I ask?
It's very likely, actually. I've often looked at Wikipedia articles and thought, you know what? Even on my worst day,
I would do better
writing an organization than that. And then, you know, donated to them anyway because, you know, they could use it. maybe they'll hire me.
That's the whole business model, right? You know, to provide content that is so awful that you just feel compelled to edit it and fix it. That's like the Wikipedia business model.
That's the thing, though, is I'm not. It doesn't matter how much I know about the topic. I do not feel compelled to fix it.
They should just call it "Go Fix Me."
I'm not interested in being a Wikipedia editor, particularly for free. So if they want to hire me, that's fine. But otherwise, I'll pass. So the article tries to divide these cognitive biases into categories that make more sense based on what is driving their evolutionary functionality. So if you are a human being or any kind of primate and you're trying to survive, there are a few problems you're going to face in terms of utilizing your cognitive resources. One is that you're going to have a lot of information coming at you, and you need a way to filter out that information because you can't process it all at once. So the next one is that you have a lack of meaning. Generally, there's not some sort of coherent synthetic worldview that's apparent in your immediate perceptions. Mm-hmm. And so you have to figure out a way to make all these bits of data coherent. And we need to do this very, very quickly. You can't sit around pondering, oh, I wonder what the genus is of this tiger, while the tiger is trying to eat you. It's a little time-consuming to try to do in that circumstance.
I would offer a slightly better example. bears, right? What kills you with a black bear saves your life with a grizzly. And you need to make that decision very, very quickly. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, what kills you is not having a large bore gun.
That too. That too.
Loaded for bear is one of my favorite idioms. But
yes. And the fourth one is you need to be able to figure out how you know what you need to really, really remember later. Mm-hmm. Some things are important to remember now in that moment when the bear is coming after you, and some things are important for later.
You put that better than he did in the article. That was the one that I got a little hung up on trying to puzzle out what he was trying to say. So, you said that very well.
Well, thank you. So these four problems kind of provide the schema by which the cognitive biases are divided up. Mm-hmm. And then the author lists out some examples of the cognitive biases that are a result of us trying to solve these problems. So, for example, we have the availability heuristic, attentional bias, illusory truth effect, mere exposure effect, context effect, which is also known as cue-dependent forgetting, mood congruent memory bias, frequency illusion, which I thought was just fascinating. I don't know if y'all are familiar with the frequency illusion.
I think it might be a segue into the cops and guns thing that I wanted to talk about, if I'm thinking of the right thing.
It might well be. So the frequency illusion is what happens when you notice something and it seems important to you or it seems novel to you. Mm-hmm. And so you start seeing it everywhere. In large part because you're looking for it now.
Yeah. Then it is an ideal segue, but we'll stick with this for a minute.
Right, but it's like what happens when you buy a new car. You know, when I first got my Mazda Protege many years ago,
Falcon.
Right, and suddenly when you buy that model of car, you notice other cars that are the same model, not because there are any more or less of them on the road than there were before, but because now you're attuned to that particular model of car. That would be the frequency illusion. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, you and I are aware of the frequency illusion, and so we don't conclude on the basis of our suddenly seeing it all the time that there's actually more of those cars out there than there were before.
I was gonna say, and the article points out, you know, the basic problems with each of our responses. The solution, to the extent there is a solution, is really just to be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be aware of that there are, in the first place, all of these things that can contribute to a sense that we know more than we know, or that we are more certain than we are. And the more specifically you know things like that. So now I know about that frequency point. In as many words, I'm going to pay more attention to that. I mean, obviously I'm aware of it. On an abstract level, but now I have a name for it, and I'm going to file that away and keep that in the back of my mind. The example that came to my mind while I was reading these was the spandrel. If you have if you have a series of columns with vaulting over the top, you end up with a kind of triangular space in between, called a spandrel. It's not an architectural decision to have a spandrel. It's just what happens as a result of having these two things. I was thinking that in the context of second one, which is that we compensate for... in my summarization of those 4 points, I turned around and said we compensate for lack of context by filling gaps with what seems like a reasonable assumption. And so you look up and you say, wow, they made this, you know, interesting decision to have this triangular space. No, it just, you know, it's an accident. It's just something that happens, but we perceive it and say, well, there must be a reason why they decided to put this in, and so we're being conned by negative space. We have backwards what they were actually trying to do, and then proceed from that probably a tacit assumption, to make a reasonable assumption about why it would be particularly attractive. You can imagine this being a problem in archaeology. You know, you run into this thing, and you're looking at it upside down, and thinking, why did these people love triangles so much? This is really weird. It's like, they didn't care about the triangles. It was just that they had these columns and these things to hold up the roof. I mean, but it seems perfectly reasonable to conclude these things are everywhere. Surely this culture loved this stuff.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the ancient aliens theories that look at these old stone carvings. They're like, clearly, this is a rocket ship. And, like, if you squint really hard and you pay attention to the rocket ship, we drew over it. It totally looks like a rocket ship.
That seems like it's a different form of biasing that ought to have a name. I can't think of what you would call it, but it's a form of projection, you know.
Yeah, I call it really, really silly.
Yeah.
Aliens.
Advanced bullshitting.
Advanced bullshitting. It's,
yeah, this is bullshitting that could not be accomplished without advanced technology.
This is bullshitting beyond human means.
This is some serious bullshit, and if you're serious about your bullshit, you might want to check out bullshit.com. Your leading provider for all your premium bullshit needs.
There are so many leading providers of that online.
I was going to say, right now we're in a presidential season that have a lot of providers of, you know, there seems to be a bullshit surplus in the American economy.
It's a bull market on bullshit.
Nice. I was going to
have another contender for the postal,
you know, and turn the bullshit into gold.
I want to talk about the police shooting things partly because it's such a nice segue from your frequency fallacy. There was a video where a vet on Facebook was complaining that all he's heard since he got back is unarmed shootings, and he wanted to know what the rules of engagement were. And the second part of that is a reasonable question. I mean, you can have that debate. What are the rules? And it's probably more complicated because, of course, on the battlefield, the other side's rules of engagement are fairly clear. The bad guys are going to shoot back. Period.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And whereas when you're dealing with a riot in, say, you know, North Carolina, you might not know what the other side's intentions are. These part of the, you know, when they say, what do we want dead cops? What do we want them? When do we want them now? Is this more bullshit or is this actually a threat? I don't know. I mean, it probably depends on the individual and you can, you know, you got to make your best judgment call. But such are the times in which we live, there is now a website that tracks all police killings, naturally. Yeah.
Well, that's been the case for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was interested that that they have a table, but they of all of these killings, but they do not mention on that table either the race of the victim, probably because the reporting is very inconsistent.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And secondly, whether the person was armed, which would seem directly relevant to the question of whether all I hear is police shootings. And it turns out that the answer is that this person is being taken in by exactly the effect that you were just mentioning. Because I did what I don't think the website wants you to do and sat down and read through every single report that they had for the month of September that thus far. This was like on September the 25th I did this. So, you know, call it, you know, a week less than the whole of September. And the bottom line was, I think, I have the numbers here. So there were 68 officer-involved shootings in which one of them, the person was unambiguously unarmed. So the person was unambiguously armed in 52 of them. Then there were seven more where de facto armed. So, for example, a man runs towards the cops pointing an object at them. Right. Or man advances towards them with his hand hidden behind his back. I don't think anyone... Whether or not they were actually armed, you have a guy approaching you, you're saying, stop, get back, show me your hands, and he's approaching towards you with his hands behind his back. You know, you've kind of got to make an assumption in that case that they're armed. Then you had three more cases where the person was armed but not with weapons that could justify the shooting. So there was someone who was armed with a piece of broken glass, armed with lead pipe, I assume that was Colonel Mustard.
It's probably in the drawing room.
Yeah.
Right. And then six more cases where it's just unclear what was going on. So the Crutcher case is a perfect example of that because there's, you know, some suggestion that he might have been armed and some suggestion that he wasn't. And, you know, it'll come out in the wash eventually. But, yeah, one case out of 68 where the person was unarmed. And you have this guy saying... All I hear is police is unarmed shootings. Well, that's because of your cognitive biasing, not because of the actual facts on the ground.
I don't know that it is because of this cognitive biases so much as that's what we're typically presented with, because that's the interesting bit of information that various websites and media outlets want to present.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it should be easy to find this thing out. You have this website, could do what could very easily add a column. That's, you know, because they have a column. They track police killings, not necessarily shootings, which is why anyone who's doing the numbers on this will find a discrepancy between the number that I mentioned and the number that they show. So, for example, there was at least one case where the cop drove into someone's car and the person was killed. That's fine. That's a killing by a police officer. Sounds to me like it wasn't deliberate, but okay, you know, but that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about police shootings. So it does seem to me that, so they have a column for whether they were killed by gun, knife, something else, whatever. Just add a column that says, was the person armed or not? I mean, this is simple stuff. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, there was some media biasing in this, certainly. Not in the usual sense of media
bias. That's part of the problem.
Sensationalism bias.
Right. Yeah, the media likes to present information that is exciting and drives their advertising revenue. And so they're going to bias themselves towards events that get people very emotionally invested in that narrative, which they can then drive that narrative for days and keep people emotionally invested in it. And keep their website traffic up and keep their viewership numbers up on television. So it's, to me, it's less about people's cognitive biases, although I think those are very, very acute, and more about we get our information from sources that are subject to, in addition to normal human cognitive biases, are subject to institutional biases that lead to presenting information that tends to make the situation even worse.
Right. Not necessarily even just ideological bias. You know, MSNBC may want to discredit Republicans, but above all, it wants to make money. Hasn't been doing a terribly good job of it from everything I read, but you know that they are far more likely on both prongs to want to cover, you know, cop shoots unarmed man than heavily armed man shoots at police is killed. You know, that's kind of
Well, I mean, Fox News is more likely to cover that. Because there are at least some people on Fox News who want to forward the war on cops narrative. And so they would love to pick up a story about heavily armed man firing on cops.
See, and that's a good example of the market correcting the problem, because then the story gets reported one way or another. The kind of the bit in between where it falls into is the story that is that neither side has an interest in reporting. Right?
Well, the issue you have with that is that the problem is that you have people, we're very exclusive media consumers now. And so you have the people who just watch Fox News, who all they will hear about is how the war on cops thing, or how these people who were shot were really this, that, and the other. And then you have the people who are consuming media on the other side, the MSNBC or the general media, and they'll never hear the other side.
Right.
So, you know, it's not really, you know, the market correction provides alternatives, but it doesn't lead to a fuller picture.
No, it doesn't. Unless you specifically decide that you want to very intentionally and disciplined in your approach, go to various sites of various ideological stripes and make sure you're canvassing the whole spectrum of information, you're going to see what you want to see. Unless you have some method of cutting against your cognitive biases, you're going to just go straight for the information sources that play to those.
And this comes back to your meta-level concern about what counts as evidence and how do we go about making evidence-based decision-making. And indeed, should we? I mean, you know, the line that I always liked from Justice Scalia that I routinely mangle was that decisions are quintessentially legislative when they involve questions of is a particular line longer than a particular rock is heavy? You know, when you are weighing incommensurates and incomparables, that's by definition a legislative decision. And the reason it is because it's very difficult to make a principled decision based on that. But in the first instance, we should all be able to agree that there should be units for measuring how long the line is, and there should be units for measuring how heavy the rock is. And quite often we're not there. You know, you have Fox News denying that there's not even a line. You know, the elites want you to believe there's a line, but there's not a line. The Bernie Bros will be insisting this rock is oppressing the class, the underclass, and you know it needs to be moved at any cost, and it doesn't matter how long the line is. It's just like it's very difficult to have those kinds of finding the proper domain of evidence and then quantifying what counts as evidence and getting enough of it to make a decision. With again the time pressure that you're talking about, is it turns out a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't blame people for deciding to be rationally ignorant of politics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is incredibly time consuming, mm-hmm. and I understand that. So if you decide, you know, I just don't know anything about politics, and I really, between working two jobs, trying to take care of my kids, I just don't have time to figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your decision, I totally respect that. That makes complete sense to me. What worries me is when people do have a lot of time on their hands, you know, they have a part-time job and they have other income support from elsewhere, or they're retired and they have plenty of money, and they still manage to be so politically misinformed,
mm-hmm.
and so intentionally and egregiously so. That worries me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't even agree that evidence matters, as I suspect, if I had the discussion with the guy in the video that I mentioned before, and pointed out to him, you know, could I have a moment of your time, respectfully, could I suggest that actually, you know, you say that all you hear is unarmed shootings, but actually the numbers are clearly at some variance with that. I mean, does this make a difference to you? I don't think that the answer is very likely to be, although it may be, oh, well, that's an interesting point. I hadn't seen that data. Thank you for sharing that. This fundamentally changes my view on this. I don't see that happening.
I think with that particular individual, it might work better.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that most of the people who are sharing that video, it would work really terribly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what worries me is we're in a post-factual age.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about facts. It's not about what's actually going on. It's very explicitly about feelings and perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to boil over with
competing feelings and perceptions.
Yeah. I mean, as we have as we have the Black Lives Matter and rather anti-cop and anti-institutional movement develop steam and gain more and more legitimacy on a national scale, that's going to run, you know, headlong into Middle America.
The All Lives Matter and the Blue Lives
Matter. Yeah, the All Lives, All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. And, you know, I have a feeling I know at least in the short term which side will win. I think, you know, the All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter are the taxpayers. These are the guys who, these are the people who hold down jobs in the middle of the country and pay taxes. And so I have a feeling push comes to shove. You know, where it really matters, which is on the streets, you know, the cops are going to keep law and order, at least in those towns.
You're more optimistic than I am. I mean, I would. My assumption is that Hillary will win the presidency, and the police will be subjected to a lot of federal scrutiny, particularly if the Democrats also take the Senate. There will then be enormous pressure on the House to approve. And you know, because, and this is something. Not as a conservative, but as a limey, or at least a recovering limey, I just find tawdry about American politics. The habit, and Black Lives Matter is a perfect example, the habit of naming things with names that no sane human could ever object to. And mm-hmm. so I will posit that the bill that federalizes control of police, or at least subjects them to a lot of supervision from the feds, will be called something like the Protect Act or the Love Act. And the people who suggest that maybe the police should not be federalized will be criticized. How can you possibly be against love? How can you be against protection? How can you say that black lives don't matter?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, this attempt to win the debate by framing one side of the debate as, you know, the Kittens and Puppies Act of 2016. You know, how could you be against kittens and puppies? You know.
I'm not. I'm for kittens and puppies and rainbows, which is why I proposed the Rainbow Act.
The Rainbow Amendment, yes, yes.
The reason why I think Middle America is going to win is because I look at the, what I'm seeing is a replay of the 1970s. And the 1970s, especially, like, we're reliving this. And it was a horrible time. We had race riots all over the place and all of that. But the Law and Order crowd eventually won. And that gave us Richard Nixon and then later Ronald Reagan. You know, Americans don't take kindly to riots in the street. We're not France.
And smartly, Trump is, you know, that was one of the major themes he tried to play up at the convention, that he's going to be the law and order candidate.
Yeah,
but he's no Richard Nixon.
No, he is no Richard Nixon.
He's way worse than Richard Nixon, is what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not necessarily a fan of Richard Nixon, but, you know, Trump is way worse. I think we can all agree.
I think we can expect tremendous corruption. Corruption that Richard Nixon could never manage.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many members of Trump's immediate family do you think will be appointed to his cabinet?
All of them. Yes. All of them. And you know what? Extended family, too.
Yeah.
I think they'll get appointments.
You know, he's going to shut the border, except he's going to have a special visa program for models for Eastern Europe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. Honestly, I think that Trump might have a special visa program just for models, period. I mean, you know, I don't know that he's particularly partial to Eastern Europe.
Yeah. They're cheaper.
Ah, well, yes.
unless they come out and say that he was an asshole to them, in which case,
he goes all Kevin O'Leary on them. You're dead to me.
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. There was totally a sex tape, guys.
Yeah, go check out that.
You didn't hear it from me.
He's totally the "you didn't hear it from me" candidate, isn't he?
It's just like, you know, some people say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I don't have tiny hands. You guys don't believe that, right? You don't really believe that I have tiny hands?
The weasel words candidate. Let's talk about something happier to wrap up. Did anyone watch Elon Musk's announcement or read about it?
I saw some of the highlights, yeah.
I watched the whole thing giggling like a giddy schoolgirl.
I bet.
I was just like, I cannot believe that I'm sitting here watching this, that this is actually really happening. It's not like some... Now, confessedly... I was about to say, it's not like watching some, you know, NASA dude in a conservative suit announcing plans to find water on Mars by 2116 and to maybe send a probe there a century after. You know, this guy is actually talking about sending people there, you know, a la Red Mars, you know, in the next decade and a half. This is just really, really terribly exciting. Notwithstanding that he's no Steve Jobs, right? You know, he has this kind of flat delivery style. And so it becomes kind of really kind of comical that someone asks him in the Q&A, he's like, whether he'll be the first man on Mars. And he says, well, I've thought about it and I don't know. And, you know, there are some issues. And so we would have to look at the possibility of the succession plan that's in place because, you know, you want to worry about, you know, who might take over the company after me and, you know, take it in a more corporate direction. And, you know, the risk of dying is terribly high on the first mission. And he may as well be saying, you know, sometimes I like to have bananas for breakfast and, you know, other days cereal, but I could really go either way. And, you know, I might die on this mission, but, you know, who can tell? Also, I really want to ask, and so sometimes I like to build robot suits and fly around fighting crime. And, you know, my last encounter with Dr. Doom was pretty tough. But, you know, it's all good. But, you know, just orange juice this morning, thank you. He's an interesting fellow, is he, Elon Musk?
He really is.
Yeah, I've read some very interesting things about him and how he thinks through problems. And I think how he thinks through problems is what makes his solutions very unique and effective.
I think it's just wonderful that in... what, 14 years? They've gone from a company that can fit in a room to a company that's routinely orbiting satellites and is seriously talking about flying rockets to Mars.
Yeah.
And has, you know, it's not just concept art. This is that these are animatics based on the engineering specs of the thing they are actually building. Mm-hmm. That they actually they are tooling up to build this thing and choosing launch sites and facilities to build it. It's just like, this is almost unreal. And they're doing it the right way. Mm-hmm. The plan is essentially to do exactly what... what's his name? Kim Stanley Robinson posited in Red Mars, that you basically send 100 people up there and they stay. I mean, they can come back if they want to. The rocket's going to come back and basically do a circuit back and forth. But, you know, you are sending not 3 people up there and one of them is going to stay in orbit. You're going to send a good number at a time, and the goal is to get up to a critical mass of 1 million or so. Mm-hmm. You know, that they are seriously taking the colonization route. It's like, yeah, that's exactly how you do it. Now, that will produce challenges of its own. They probably won't be the challenges that Kim Stanley Robinson thought they were going to be. Red Mars is the first book in a trio. If you've not read it, read the first one. The second one kind of falls off quite quickly. The third one's pretty terrible. Because they are you really feel the limitations of a Clinton-era Democrat to write this, the social changes that will entail from colonizing another planet, and mm-hmm. when people are born on that planet, and what is their sense of loyalty towards the, you know, the mother civilization, mm-hmm. all of these complex issues that come up, he just doesn't really have the breadth of worldview to imagine what that could look like, but these are concerns that are going to happen. If we do this and we go there, and you know he's, you know, it doesn't take a lot to get me weepy, but he had a line, and I made a note of it because it's so good. One path is to stay on Earth forever, and there'll be some extinction event. The alternative is to become a multiplanetary species. I hope you agree which way is the right one to go. It's like, I could have wept. I could have kissed the guy. It's just like, this is fantastic that someone with the resources to say this is actually saying this.
Yeah, I mean, it really breathes some right in, or it breathes some life into the great man theory.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that that you have certain great men and women throughout history who can almost single-handedly change the course. Now, there's a high probability that he fails and he doesn't actually change the course of history. I do recall seeing an advertisement. Pan Am took reservations for the hotel on a moon after the Apollo missions, saying that in the future hypersonic jets will bring people to the moon. And you can stay on the moon. So call Pan Am and make your reservation for your grandchildren. So, you know, it's possible that he won't be successful, but it's good to see someone like thinking so large and so, you know, millions of years into the future.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me, I've not seen the Pan Am thing, but the immediate thing that strikes me is the assumption that you are going to have hotels on the moon. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think Musk would be clear-sighted enough to say, well, we'll have oil rigs on the moon. And we'll have, I mean, not oil rigs, but, you know, we'll have
mining operations,
and we will have fueling. You know, he's talking about putting the flight system that they are building could theoretically take us anywhere in the solar system, assuming that you have refueling posts seeded in various key locations. And mm-hmm. you can do that part robotically. So, you know, you send out your fueling tanker or your cheap one-shot fueling tanker to Titan, right? And you send a stream of them and, you know, a robot facility to tie it together. And so basically when the manned ship reaches Titan, there's fuel already there waiting for it. This kind of thinking is astute, right? You know, when why would we go to any of these things other than the idealistic reason of we need to become a multiplanetary civilization if we're going to avoid being, you know, wiped out by a stray asteroid? Mm-hmm. Well, the practical incentive is profit. Right, there's you know, there are enormous resources to be had from mining the asteroid belt, mm-hmm. helium. Right, we are running out of extractable helium on Earth rapidly. This is one of the most abundant elements in the cosmos, as I understand it. But there's a limited amount of it on Earth, So you go elsewhere and you get it from, you know, the atmosphere of Jupiter or whatever. This is, you know, there's an obvious commercial incentive. I think that Pan Am thing is very much a product of its time. It's just like, it's very Star Trek future.
Yes.
It's very, we're just all going to have leisure. You know, I realize we've talked on a previous episode about post-scarcity economies. That isn't going to happen. The future is going to look like Babylon 5, not Star Trek. We are going to be greedy little muckers for a long time to come, and we're going to be trying to extract resources. And that seems to be his insight, that the way you pay for the idealism is profit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I hope that there are at least co-pilots on the ships that bring the helium back,
mm-hmm.
and that they speak in really high-pitched voices.
Indeed.
They're telling NASA about their re-entry sequence.
Successfully captured the helium! Roger!
No, we haven't been indulging. Why do you ask? There may be a leak somewhere.
The humanity!
Heston, we have a problem.
Tell my wife I love her!
Oh. Anyone else have anything on SpaceX?
I saw some people were already commenting that he might be violating international treaties. Which, these have to be like the saddest sourpusses ever.
Yeah.
You can't do that! That's violating international law!
Get off my space lawn!
Yeah, I think, don't most countries in the world violate international law, like, every 5 minutes?
Yeah, but you gotta be a country to do that.
Hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. I was gonna suggest that we do a Mad Dogs and Englishmen-style ending, and wrap up today's podcast with an exhaustive list of all the bishops, the loss of whom would diminish the church's effectiveness were they to be sent to Mars. If you're Anthony Weiner, what is going through your head? I can't imagine.
Which head?
Insert sound effect here.
Yeah. Wah, wah.